Welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show, where we explore spiritual ideas and books that help you live a better life. Hosted by spiritual teacher and author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate, Jason Napolitano.
All right, welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show. I have today with me Chris Sheridan on the phone. He is the co-host of the show today, and we're going to be examining the book He by Robert Johnson. Chris is a spiritual teacher and author of The Spirit in the Sky. Welcome, Chris.
Good to be here, Jason. Thank you.
Thanks for showing up again. And if anyone listened to our podcast last week, it's new, but I would like to refer you to that. We did The Secret Teachings of All Ages by Manly Hall. And if I do say so myself, we did a pretty great job, Chris.
Sounds good.
Get a little round of applause
for yes. ourselves. And a pat on the back.
All right, so you are chrissheridan.com. That is where we can find you.
Yes.
And your book is The Spirit in the Sky, Chris Sheridan. And that's available on Amazon. I am Jason Napolitano. And I am at cosmiceye.org, or of course on this podcast, and the information's in the bio. And my book is If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate, which is available on Amazon now. So there, we got those plugs out of the way.
All right.
Let's jump into Mr. Robert Johnson. So I'm going to go ahead and just quickly contextualize this by reading the bio of Robert Johnson's bio in the version of the book that I have. I have He, and he is let me get the total title here, because I like to read the full title as I did last week with Secret Teachers. So this is He, a contribution to understanding masculine psychology based on the legend of Parsifal and his search for the Grail and using Jungian psychological concepts by Robert Johnson. So let me read Robert Johnson's quick bio. He actually passed away. I just saw it today. I did not know this, but September 12, 2018, and he was 97 years old. All right, so let me get into this real quick. Robert A. Johnson was born in 1921 in Portland, Oregon. He attended the University of Oregon and Stanford University, then studied under Fritz Kunkel in Los Angeles. That was at the C.G. Jung Institute, the early C.G. Jung Institute in L.A. This led to study at the C.G. Jung Institute in Zurich, Switzerland, and further work under Tony Sussman in London, England. Mr. Johnson has made a specialization of the synthesis of Christianity and the work of C.G. Jung. The rest of this does not apply because he has passed away, but he did a lot of work at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in San Diego, and John Sanford, who's also an excellent Jungian and I believe still alive, worked with him a lot. All right, so let's jump into this. I wanted to first kind of set it out why. And we'll both, you know, have our ideas about this. I think we're both on the same page, but maybe in different ways or what have you. Why we think this book is important. Why don't I let you start, since I've been yammering? So please tell me.
Okay. Well, for me personally, being a guy, I have wrestled with many of these issues. I was able to see my story in this story of Parsifal, and also get some clues and cues on how to move through it. And it explains a lot of some of the troubles I've had in my growth and maturity over the years. It makes me feel not alone, because obviously other people have had this enough to where people are writing books about it. So it's perhaps some universal themes, but I got some good ideas on how to approach my life and my maturity as a male. And also, it's timely not just in my life as I'm in middle age, it's timely in our time and age, where, well, the short version is that masculinity is under attack, but I think it's a much deeper and more complex problem with that. Masculinity needs to be matured. Men need to, and unfortunately, it seemed to be really cut off from some of the myths. Fatherhood is really down, especially in a lot of communities. Sure. With imprisonment, or you know, off to work or off to war, and all
Absolutely.
These things. You know, a richer, more in-depth understanding of what it means to be a man and how to go about doing it. And what's so interesting about this book, even though, yes, it's He and it's understanding masculine psychology, much of the story and much of the analysis really has to do with the feminine and how these relationships play out from a mother to a lover to a idealized archetype of what a woman should be. You know, this is it's very, very important part of the story. It's not just going off and slaying the dragon. It's really how to be a man in so many ways. And a very important way is to be a smart man as far as your relationship with the women in your life.
Absolutely. And I think that makes a good point. And I think really one of the things he talks about throughout the book is how, you know, the book and the Grail legend itself, the Grail story is a map to understanding the inner feminine world, and not a map for dealing with outer flesh and blood women, because you said it all falls apart if you try to approach them in the way you would in your inner psychology. Speaking of that, let's just touch on really quickly before we do the synopsis of the Grail myth, because I want to make sure we've set this up for the listener if they're not familiar. So the Grail that we're talking about is the Holy Grail, and the mythology behind that, and I'm not saying it's not true, but the mythology in the big sense of the word mythology, in its symbolic sense, is the cup that was used at the Last Supper. And in addition, it was also the cup that caught the water and the blood that flowed from Christ's side when he was pierced by the Roman soldier. And it was Joseph of Arimathea that caught that blood in the chalice, if I'm not mistaken. And in most mythology that I know. So that's the Grail. Do you have anything to add to that?
Very clear way of describing it. Okay. Sure. And the Grail too, it's often seen as a metaphor, a symbol for the womb. Mm-hmm. So even the Grail itself has
feminine,
a feminine
quality. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, as well.
And so it's into this, it's with this symbolic understanding that we have to look at this story. The second thing that I want to kind of contextualize is the idea of the feminine within man may not, if people aren't, you know, used to archetypal psychology, they may not understand what that means. So I'll briefly have you explain what the anima is, what Jung's concept of the anima, A-N-I-M-A. How do you understand that?
Well, my understanding is that there is a feminine side or part of every male, and the flip side is the animus, which would be the masculine component within the feminine. And it's... one of the ways I visualize it is with the Tai Chi, with the yin yang symbol. Mm-hmm. So you have, you know, this curved kind of half dark side, and this other side is the light side. But within the dark side, there's a white dot, and within the light side, there's a black dot. That is a kind of a nice visual. I always go to that when I think of anima and animus. So always in my mind, I go to that visual representation.
Oh, great. Yeah.
You can clearly see, the yin and the yang and the yang and the yin, or the, as
sure.
I said, the
that's
masculine
a great,
in the feminine.
That's a great point. And,
and it's an inner character, and we'll maybe get to this, but Johnson makes a clear distinction that there's a difference between your inner feminine, your anima, than it is for actual flesh and blood women out
in the
real world. And it can become really problematic when you try to confuse the two or cross one over to the other.
That's a great point.
They serve different, they take a different approach. But the easy, you know, I guess the easy way to say, well, it's, you know, a man getting in touch with his feminine side, and the stereotype maybe seen in commercials. You know, you have this burly man, and he's He-Man, and he does this, and he barbecues and burps and drinks his beer and all that. And then he takes a ballet class or something to get in touch with his feminine side. And that's cute and very surfacey.
Yeah.
But it's, and that may be true, but there's a lot more.
But
it,
in essence, I think
that
what you were saying is important, that really the anima is not about, you know, putting on a tutu and, you know, running around with your daughter and, you know, pretending like you're a woman. It's more about creating a good relationship with the inner feminine portion of yourself, if you're a man, so that you can then effectively deal with and form relationship with the women and girls and so forth in your life. And I think that's a really important role that this book plays. In other words, it's a guide to do just such a thing. And I think, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but I think, you know, that's kind of one of the reasons many people have trouble with masculinity today, is because they see so much poisoned quality of masculinity, where you see this adolescent behavior, this chest thumping and fighting and, you know, and brinksmanship and so on that a lot of politicians and business leaders and so on engage in. And that is not a positive type of masculinity. What really is going on is they have a very bad relationship with their inner feminine, and then it comes out in nasty ways on society, I think. And that's one of the problems. We don't have a lot of leaders who emulate the king energy, the positive masculine energy, any longer, where they've actually integrated the anima in. So we don't have a lot of good role models. So that's why, another reason contextualizing the book, why it's so important to read these myths like Parsifal and so forth, and the Arthurian legends and so on, so we can get some sort of archetypal understanding of what this energy is all about, because there are very few human representatives of it today. Would you agree?
I would agree. And where this really points to in this myth and in so many others, that towards the end, somebody, you know, comes home, or they, you know, solve a problem or heal something or conquer something, that it's a path towards completeness and wholeness in the person, within the individual.
Exactly.
That for a man to really be a man, a complete person, just happens to be a man, but a male person needs to understand and embrace the anima, the feminine, the interior feminine,
yeah,
in a proper way. First of all, to understand it, and then to actually integrate. And then in doing so, not only do you become a better man in your relationships with women, you just become a better man, and of course, by extension, a better person, because you are more complete. And the flip side, for women to do the same. And the thing about getting this other gender side, archetypal gender, integrated, is that that's not matured. It's usually not understood, mm-hmm, with a lot of people.
Yep.
And then with these caricature images that we see in media, it's very stereotyped and really just kind of comical and very surfacey.
Exactly.
Version of it that we never really embrace. And it doesn't mean, well, I'm going to embrace my feminine side, so I'm going to give up all my spears and hunting garb, and I'm going to, you know, just not be a man anymore. It doesn't mean that at all. As a matter of fact, you become a much better man.
Absolutely.
And the reason why, and this book points to this, where, you know, men are having so many problems, is because their anima, their feminine archetypal side, has not been integrated. But the consciousness and the soul tries to come up with a solution. And if not done properly, usually this solution in quotes can cause more trouble than
absolutely
than it's
because
worth.
Then it becomes this I think what we see today, where you get this over I don't want to say this, the kind of the stereotypical masculinity, meaning the dark side of that masculinity, which it's not, that's not the non-integrated you know, poisoned side of masculinity. And that's where I think people have to differentiate between the different qualities. Masculinity is a rainbow of different qualities. And I think, you know, in the United States especially, we've stereotyped it down to playing football, drinking beer, eating chips and burping and farting or something like this. And then maybe getting in a bar brawl or something occasionally to really assert. But, you know, it's not that. Certainly masculinity has qualities of combat and of acquisitiveness and aggressiveness and assertiveness. And when those things are properly channeled, they are extremely valuable tools. And I think a lot of young men today don't have those tools. And that's one of the reasons why I would highly recommend this book, especially to the young men today who may not have male role models around and so forth. So with that being said, we're getting way ahead of ourselves, but let's jump into a synopsis of this mythology so that the listener who has not heard this myth before at least is in, you know, in the time and place and can understand this. So this comes from about the 12th century. This is the French version, kind of a synopsis of the French version of the poem, excuse me, by Chrétien de Troyes. My French is very poor, so excuse me for that.
I'll excuse your French.
Excuse my French. So let me go to the synopsis really quickly, and I will begin reading, and then you're going to take over at that spot we designated.
Sure.
All right, so here we go. Synopsis of the Grail legend. The Holy Grail, the chalice of the Last Supper, is kept within a castle. The king of the castle has been wounded severely and suffers all the time. The whole land and all its people are in desolation. The king had been wounded early in his adolescence. While wandering in a forest, he had reached a camp which was empty except for a spit on which a salmon was roasting. He was hungry, so he took a bit of the salmon. He burned his fingers horribly. To assuage the pain, he put his fingers into his mouth and tasted a bit of the salmon. So he is called the Fisher King because he was wounded by a fish. He was also wounded in the thighs, so he is no longer productive, and his whole land is no longer productive. The Fisher King lies on a litter, which must be carried everywhere, and he is able sometimes to fish, and only then is he happy. The Fisher King presides over the castle where the Grail is kept, but he cannot touch the Grail or be healed by it. The court fool is prophesied that the Fisher King would be healed when a wholly innocent fool arrives in the court. In an isolated country, a boy lives with his widowed mother, whose name is Heart Sorrow. At first, the boy does not have a name. Much later, he learns his name is Parsifal. His father had been killed while rescuing a fair maiden, and his two brothers had also been killed as knights. His mother had taken him to a far country and raised him in primitive circumstances. He wears homespun clothes, has no schooling, asks no questions. He's a simple, naive youth. Early in his adolescence, he sees five knights riding by on horseback. He's dazzled by the knights, their scarlet and gold trappings, their armor, and all their accoutrements. He dashes home to tell his mother that he has seen five gods and he wants to leave home to go with them. His mother weeps. She had hoped that he would not suffer the fate of his father and his brothers, but she gives him her blessing and three instructions. He must respect all fair maidens. He's to go daily to church where he'll receive all the food he needs, and he is not to ask any questions. Parsifal goes off to find the knights. He never finds the same five knights, but he has all kinds of adventures. One day he comes to a tent. He had only known a simple hut, so he thinks that this is the church his mother had told him about. He sees a fair damsel wearing a ring on her hand, so he obeys his mother's instructions by embracing the damsel, taking her ring and putting it on his own hand. He sees a table set for a banquet, and thinking it is the food his mother had told him he would find in the church, he eats it, not realizing it's prepared for the damsel's beloved knight. The damsel begs Parsifal to leave because if her knight finds him there, he will kill him. Parsifal goes on his way and soon finds a devastated convent and monastery. He cannot restore them, but he vows to return and raise the spell when he is stronger. Is this where you're going to take over, or is it the next one?
Sure, I can start from here.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Okay. Then he meets a red knight who has come from King Arthur's court. Parsifal is dazzled by the knight and tells him that he too wants to be a knight. The red knight tells him to go to Arthur's court, which he does. In this court is a damsel who has not smiled nor laughed for 6 years. A legend says that when the best knight in the world comes along, she will smile and laugh again. When she sees Parsifal, she bursts into laughter. The court is impressed. Arthur knights Parsifal, gives him a page, and tells him that he may have the horse and armor of the red knight if he can get it. Parsifal finds the red knight, kills him, and takes his armor and puts it on over his homespun clothing. He finds his way to the castle of Gournemond, who trains him to be a knight. Gournemond gives him two instructions. He must never seduce or be seduced by a woman. And when he reaches the Grail Castle, he must ask, Whom does the Grail serve? Parsifal goes off and tries to find his mother and help her, but he finds that she died of a broken heart. Then he meets Blanche Fleur. From this time on, everything he does is in her service. She asks him to conquer the army besieging her castle, which he does, and then he spends the night with her. After traveling all the next day, he meets two men in a boat. One of them, who was fishing, invites Parsifal to stay at his house for the night. When Parsifal reaches this house, he finds himself in a great castle where he is royally welcomed. He learns that the fisherman is the Fisher King. He sees a ceremony in which a youth carries a sword that drips blood constantly, and a maiden carries the Grail. At a banquet, the Grail is passed about, and everyone drinks from it. The Fisher King's niece brings a sword, and the king straps it to Parsifal's waist. But Parsifal fails to ask the question that Gornamond had asked him to ask. The next morning, Parsifal finds that all the people of the castle have vanished, so the castle disappears. So he then goes on and finds a sorrowful maiden. He learns that her knight had been killed by the jealous knight of the maiden of the tent. So the death was really his fault. When she learns that he had been in the Grail Castle, she berates him for all his sins and tells him that the land and all its people will continue to be desolate. That's the right question. Later, he finds again the maiden of the tent. She reiterates all his misdeeds and tells him that the sword he had been given will break the first time it is used in battle, that it can only be mended by the smith who made it, and that after that, it will never break again. In the course of his journeys, Parsifal has subdued many knights and sent them back to King Arthur's court. When he had been there before, they had not realized who he was. Arthur sets forth to search for Parsifal so the court can honor him. Parsifal happens to be camping nearby. A falcon attacks three geese and wounds one of them. Its blood on the snow reminds Parsifal of Blanche Fleur, and he falls into a trance. Two of Arthur's men see him and try to persuade him to return to the court, but he unhorses them. A third knight, Gawain, gently persuades him to go to the court with him. Parsifal is received in triumph at the court. But the rejoicing ends when a hideous damsel on a decrepit mule enters and recites all of Parsifal's sins. This is the third time it seems to be happening. She points a finger at him and says, "It is all your fault." She assigns tasks to all the knights. She tells Parsifal to search for the Grail Castle again, and this time ask the right question. So they all seem to know what's going on more than he does. Parsifal goes on through many episodes. Some versions say that he travels for 5 years. Others say 20 years. He grows bitter and disillusioned. He does many heroic deeds, but he forgets the church, Blanche Fleur, and the Grail Castle. Then one day he meets some pilgrims who ask him why he is armed on Good Friday. He suddenly remembers what he had forgotten. Remorsefully, he goes with the pilgrims to a hermit for confession. The hermit absolves him and tells him to go immediately to the Grail Castle. Okay, the poem stops here. Many authors have tried to finish it. One version says that Parsifal goes on to the Grail Castle and this time asks the right question, whom does the Grail serve? The answer is given, the Grail serves the Grail King. He is not the Fisher King, but the Grail King who has lived in the central room of the castle from time immemorial. The Fisher King is healed immediately and the land and all its people can live in peace and joy.
Beautiful. Great reading. Thank you. All right. Okay. So let's get into this. And break it down a little bit. I mean, I really just kind of wanted to share that story with people who might not be familiar with this legend and just contextualize it. Honestly, please read this book, any men, and especially young men, because I think you will get a great deal out of it. But we're going to go into some of the details, at least some of the more important things that stick out to us. And
before we do, can I just throw in one more thing about the legend itself? And this was probably common of mm-hmm. legends and myths of the time, that the kingdom is only as good as the king, that if the king is suffering, the people will be suffering. If the king can't reproduce, then the people can't. So that the good of the nation or the people was really tied in or was perceived to be tied in to the well-being of the king. So that's one of the reasons, you know, to heal the
absolutely. And one
Grail King is so the Fisher King, and thus the people can be.
Good point. And one could argue that that is still true today. First off, one thing I wrote down in my notes as I was going through this is really just to kind of go back and put a quick definition, I guess, on the word myth. Myth these days gets a pretty bad rap, as we've talked about many times, in that it's off the word myth is often used synonymously to mean something false or something, a fake tale or a story that doesn't hold true any longer, or so forth. I think that, and this idea was something that I think was propagated in the kind of materialist outlook and the rational sort of, you know, world during the Enlightenment and up to our modern age. But I think a lot of times that people have in the West have looked at mythology as a sort of a primitive account of a scientific explanation of something that the primitive mind, quote unquote, could not grasp. And really, the way we're using the word is something that is a truth that is timeless. Would you agree?
Sure. One definition I like is a myth is a story that never was, but always is.
So now in light of the fact that we have been having a few little technical issues on our side, we're just going to get back into the unconscious a little bit, the collective unconscious, and Jung's definition of that that comes from the book. And Jung says that myths are spontaneous presentations from the collective unconscious of psychological and spiritual truths. So these are things that well up from the collective unconscious to give humanity at large the wisdom it needs to navigate the world, basically. Dreams, in contrast to that, are individual messages from the individual unconscious to help one navigate his or her life with some kind of clarity and consciousness. So for Jung, obviously myths have meaning for everyone because they represent in story archetypes. And an archetype, which we haven't really gotten into, but a really nice definition in the book is archetypes are patterns of life which are universally valid. So these are patterns within and without that structure and give us energy, and we find them in all of our symbolism, mythology, religion, and so on, the archetypal energies that exist in the universe. We don't really have necessarily hard and fast names for these, but, you know, we do have some ideas of different functions, and they're played out in things like the gods and in different tales and so forth. So, for example, you know, the communicative quality of man might be Hermes or Mercury, depending on the mythology you're speaking of, and so on. So this is what's meant by the archetypal. We really hadn't talked about that yet. Do you have anything to add to that?
Well, just that it is very important. It's like if myths are the stories, then, you know, the archetypes are the characters and the events that happen, you know, within the myth. And we can all be, you know, it's like a prototype or a overreaching type that we all have, you know, the child within. We all have the survivor instinct. Sure. Now, it's how we play those out in our lives that makes a difference in the expression, but in the essence of the archetype, you know, they are universal patterns. Who was it? I think it was Larson who said that myths are stored in the body. That we have the receptor for all these myths and archetypes. It's think, just which one triggers, you know, that comes up. And
yeah,
oh, now I'm connecting with this one. Or we see it in a movie that we relate to the character because maybe we're not like that character in real life, but archetypally underneath it all, yeah.
That's a great point. And I think one of the interesting things that Jungian psychology does bring to the surface in a way that a lot of psychologies don't today it is the idea that we have, that we do have multiple sort of parts of ourselves, if you want to call it that. And, you know, some people criticize that as sound, you know, it sounds like, oh, well, like I'm Sybil or something. I've got all these multiple personalities and so on. And so they criticize Jung's theories, but I think that that's very short-sighted, because if you just give a little thought to yourself in your own life, how many times have we been seized by something from within that causes us to do something and we can't understand why the hell we did it?
Right.
That's, you know, that's a possession by a complex, a part of ourself that is somewhat autonomous of the ego. I think that's what scares us, is that these things can seize us or give us energies or moods or depressions or so forth. And, you know, in some ways it feels as if they're beyond our control, you know? So what we're striving for in the Jungian work is a strong ego, strong consciousness, so that we can kind of ride those out, but we can also come into relationship with those things, not necessarily try to control them or squash them or what have you, because our genius also lies in those different parts of ourselves. And that gets into also the idea of the shadow within. And can you share a little bit about the shadow in Jungian thought?
Well, sure. It's the parts of us that are distant. They're kept hidden from us. Sometimes it's just a part of ourselves we're unfamiliar with, or we never mm-hmm. really got to connect with. Other elements in the shadow are ones that we purposely shove down there because we don't want to deal with them. They become scary.
A rejection, man. They're rejected parts of ourselves, would you say?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. And the shadow is not always negative. The shadow is it's just hidden. It's dark. That's hidden either from us or sometimes, like we said, hidden by us. Stuffed down into this shadow. Oh, I don't, that's the ancient history. That's in the back of my mind. Oh, I'm not going to go there. Okay. And you know, that's fine for a while, but they do persist. And if they're not dealt with, in a very positive and often nurturing kind of way, mm-hmm. They will rise up, and seek expression. And exactly. That's when these shadow complexes, you know, show up, and we're like, oh my gosh,
yeah.
You know, where'd that come from?
That's a great point. And, you know, doing this work, reading books like he, watching one's dreams and so on, help to raise the level of consciousness. So you can start to see some of these things operating within yourself and see these processes, happening, and hopefully, you know, gain some sort of, semblance of relationship to them so that they don't swamp you. And I think that's the real challenge, you know. And today I think people are so sort of in the ego and in the materialistic viewpoint that they have trouble sometimes accepting the idea that there's a multiplicity of things going on in the soul, if they will even recognize that there is a soul. Interesting side note, and we've talked about this a million times, the very word psychology is psyche. Is the soul, and it's the study of the soul. And, you know, modern psychology doesn't even posit that there is a soul most of the time. So it's an interesting kind of challenge there, I think, today, since we've gotten away from some of the ancient ideas and ancient ways of speaking about things, and we're using all these scientific terminologies to sort of understand ourselves. But anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself and sort of going off track. So let me get back to this book. And let us say that then, by describing all these things, I mean, the Parsifal story then is a way that a young man, or a man of any age, really, in middle age, it's equally appropriate. It's really appropriate at any stage in your life, I would say, and I'm sure you would agree, mm-hmm. of trying to navigate the challenges of masculinity and growth and maturation and carving one's career and life out. Would you agree with that?
Oh, definitely. And it can help us, you know, these myths can help us through those stages, through these stories, these allegories,
yeah.
That where we see a character do this and we go, oh my gosh, you know, I'm not a knight, in the 12th century, so I'm not going to do what Parsifal did. But in my own way, I'm taking a similar journey. And by reading this myth, I can get some ideas on how I can approach mine.
That's a great point. One thing I wanted to look at that I think is a challenging issue today in my book is on page 35. And these are some of the challenges that occur when one is not in good relationship with one's anima, that feminine part of the masculine psychology. And this is, I think, something that's really pretty amazing about this book. And just one of the things that's important to look at, there are so many more, but he's talking about how the anima, one needs to come into a conscious relationship with that femininity. And there is, let me get to 36 here. He's talking about these definitions of different experiences that a man has, especially in the United States. And we have kind of a difficulty with all of these things. And it's the differences between the distinctions between emotion, feeling, and mood. Emotion, feeling, and mood. And for me, that's around 35. I think it's going to be a little forward for you. It's 36 or 37 towards the bottom. But I'm going to talk a little bit about that by reading this because it's really quite brilliant. So most people, and he's speaking of most men, lump these experiences together indiscriminately. For them, a mood is an emotion and is a feeling. We must not do this, for the distinctions to be made between these experiences enable a man to distinguish his inner woman and help him see clearly the way she operates in his psychology. So we'll spend some time on this. Emotion is a sum of energy that occurs or is set off in a person by a meaningful experience. Its chief characteristic is its energy. So he goes on to say emotions morally neutral, et cetera, et cetera. But emotion then he's talking about is a quality of energy that comes up. And this is where it becomes interesting and I think important for today. And this is where a lot of people go off track, especially in the United States, because we're not a very feeling oriented culture. Feeling in terms of the four functions of thinking, feeling, sensation, and intuition in the Jungian. So if you want, actually, I don't want to go off track, but Google that four functions, Jung, and there's great stuff online about that. So, but feeling is an act of valuing. And that kind of brings me back to that idea of Manly Hall's definition of philosophy as a weighing of values and so forth. And this is what I think is really missing today in young people. And in all of us, really, but in young people especially, because they're not taught how to value things properly. And a value is like, I like this, I love that, I feel this is right, I feel this is wrong, this doesn't work for me at all. And it's a very sort of, gut-oriented sort of a thing. But at the same time, there's wisdom and intelligence in feeling, and it's more about valuing than it is about emotion. And I think that's a really big difference. And then the last thing that he goes into is mood. And this is one of the real strengths of this book, is it explains how a man can deal with some of these moods and how he needs to approach them. And that is what happens is moods, a man gets seized by his moods, and they come from the anima, from the feminine part of oneself. And, you know, you can see that when you're fighting with your girlfriend or your wife or so on, you know, you're stuck in this sort of anima role where you're trying to argue and you're all emotional and so on. And then the woman gets stuck in her animus role, her masculine role, and then she begins attacking you. And it's never a pretty thing when that happens. The biggest tragedies occur when those complexes take a man and a woman over. And, you know, that is a big part of this book, is teaching men how to come to a relationship within themselves and how to deal with those moods. You don't have to be seized by them. You don't have to be seized by depression or these different things. And I thought that was a huge contribution. I had not really read that before I read this book. in such a concise way. Did that strike you as well?
It did, and it's an interesting distinction between mood and feeling. Now, he kind of defines his own terms, so we can talk on that level, but it's often we can use them interchangeably. Well, I'm in a bad mood. Well, I have a bad feeling. But the way he describes them,
they're very precise, right?
Yeah. The feeling is the ability to value, and mood is being overtaken or possessed by the inner feminine, as he said.
Exactly. Yeah.
So the feelings maybe are more true. They're more, whether the feeling is good or bad, they're more true to nature. Whereas a mood might just be temporal and, well, somebody said the wrong thing or the dog barked and now I'm in a bad mood. If we approach things on the level of mood, we're not going to get very far. But if we really get in touch with the feelings, then we have leverage to get somewhere.
Exactly. And I think, again, you know, I mean, we're going into getting towards the end of our discussion today. Obviously, like we said at the beginning, we're not going to be able to cover every single thing in this book. But the greatest thing about this book, I think, is the way that it weaves the story of Parsifal and his Grail quest and so on into a psychological exploration. So it's a very interesting and lively read for me. In that, you know, you're following the story of Parsifal, but also there's little asides all throughout it explaining the different symbolism and then explaining how you can apply that as a man or even as a woman. This is an important book for a woman to read as well, and he makes that point so that she can understand her sons, her lovers, her husbands, what have you. You know, people she works with in greater detail, which is why it's important also for men to read She and We, so that we can see both sides. Would you say that's true?
It is true. And an interesting, among other many interesting points he makes, is that a lot of the trouble in, say, a male-female relationship, it's not that it's toxic masculinity that's causing a problem. It's more the man's immature and maybe unrealized feminine side that has become toxic, and that's what comes out in an interaction with women. So think, well, the guy's just being a jerk. No, it's his lack of connection and integration of his anima, his feminine side, his feminine aspect, that maybe he has a false sense of it, or something is incorrect, and it's from that point of view that, say, and I, to give an example from the book, that is, if you have a sense of, you know, what a woman is supposed to do, say in your life, say in a relationship, a spouse or, lover relationship, if you're confusing that relationship with, say, the mother relationship that maybe you had as a child, well, then as an adult, you're going to expect your wife now to, wash your socks and make everything better for you. When you cry, she's going to comfort you. And while those aren't unreasonable, it's the importance and it's the insistence that, oh, if you don't do these things like mommy did to me when I was a baby, then I'm going to be angry and I'm going to come out, and it will come out like a spoiled child or an unruly child.
Yeah, that's a great point. Is the differentiation within a man's life when he's able to come to some understanding of his own feminine interior nature, it actually will enhance his relationships in the flesh and blood world with actual girls and women in his life. And I think that's one of the real strengths of this book. And you know, it's getting back to what you're saying there. I love this. This is a very interesting section that Robert Johnson writes, and it's his words, not mine. Mood is being overwhelmed or possessed by some inferior feminine content in one's unconscious. When seized by a mood, it is as though a man has become an inferior woman. Modern slang puts it aptly. He just becomes bitchy. That's all. So you know, that's an interesting thing. And that's, you know, nothing against women or not intended to put anyone down. It's a very interesting thing, though. What you were saying before is, you know, a lot of men's nastiness is their non-assimilated feminine qualities being acted out in very destructive ways. And I think that he puts it very succinctly there when he describes that. And I think many women, when they hear that, would go, "Yes, exactly. That's what he does. That's what he does when he's acting like a baby or mama's boy or whatever he's pulling when they're fighting and she's upset at him, or he's just acting out." Right. So yes. I think those are really important things. These differentiations. It's important, though, for us not to throw the baby out with the bathwater, because there is some negative or poison masculine energy out there. It does not mean that masculinity is the enemy.
But we're not talking about gender. If we are talking about men and women, we're really talking about, and so is Jung and Johnson and really any of the analytic and archetypal psychologists, depth psychologists, is that you're just talking about a quality. An aspect, very strong, very powerful.
Yes.
And like yin and yang, relating it to masculine and feminine things. You could say, well, the sun is masculine and the moon is feminine. It's not a gender assignment, but we're talking about qualities and energies. Well, and there's good and bad on both sides.
Sure. That's really, we're kind of coming to the end of the discussion, and we didn't get into everything that we could have. Obviously, there's so much in this book. So what I would want people to leave with is to kind of understand, the basic gist of it. And it's, he is a telling of the Parsifal myth, his search for the Holy Grail, and the psychological and symbolic understandings that go along with that mythology. So basically it's a book on masculinity and how to grow, how to understand, how to incorporate the feminine part of yourself, but also how to incorporate the constructive masculine elements as well. So really an important book for men to read today. And I highly recommend it. It's a short read. It's an easy read, but a very important one. And it's something that if you do read it, you will probably go back and read it again and again, like I do, and as you do as well. Do you have anything else to add to that?
Well, sure. In the years I've been involved with this book, although the text hasn't changed, I have changed, and my knowledge and experience have evolved. And it's almost like reading the book again new. I find something new, or you're at a different phase. So, yeah, it's definitely meant to be reread.
That's
it's
a great
not
point.
Just a one time. It's almost like a living document. And as you move through your mythological journey, the book will actually take on a different voice.
Good point. And I mean this also kind of ties back into what we were talking about at the beginning of the discussion. It's more important today than ever for men, especially young men, but even older men in middle age and so forth, to reconnect with both the masculine part of themselves and the feminine. In a lot of ways, more of the work today, especially with the way school is set up and most families are set up and most young men are raised by single women and so forth, a lot of this excavation work and a lot of the sort of repair work that's going to go on in the masculine psyche is going to be retrieving some of those masculine qualities and starting to live those out. Because, many men today, as opposed to maybe in the 70s when this was written, that generation, many men today would probably lean more towards the feminine side than they would the masculine. So now they've got to get in touch with that, that knight energy, that red knight energy he talks about, which you'll read about in the book, that masculine aggressive energy that needs to also be assimilated. So, that's important as well. Do you have anything to add to that?
Well, it asks the question that needs to be asked over and over again, just what is masculinity? What is good, positive, effective masculinity? What are those traits, and how can we recognize them in others, and how can we cultivate them within ourselves?
And
like I said, you know, with media images and things, it's very easy to get into a debate or conflict when you're just looking at surface, very kind of material, like I said, almost like a caricature of these energies.
Exactly.
It's harder work to get past that and move more inside, move a little deeper, let go of maybe what the knee-jerk reaction might be to, well, toxic femininity. What's that? It's the patriarchy's fault. Now, set that aside and let's look at these energies and archetypes and see how we can work with them. So it takes a little patience, takes a little bit of strength, and you have to just really get out of that reactionary mode and take a look at things.
That's a good point. And also it does require some contrary thinking, because I would argue that most of the media today presents what you're talking about, caricatures and negative stereotypes of masculine energy. It's all in most of the television shows, and most of the films today present masculine figures as buffoons or idiots or jokes or malicious criminals.
Those seem to be the two extremes that are the choices kind of given to us. Yeah, it's the ineffectual husband who's, oh yes, honey, okay, dude, can't really do anything. You just sit there on the couch, honey, and drink your beer and watch the game. It'll be all right.
Yeah, and I'll fix everything.
Or he's an axe murderer and a serial killer and stuff. Yeah, it seems to be, again, it's these extremes are, you know, they're fine for drama on TV, but
I understand that. But and I agree. But unfortunately, you know, the media is a big influence on everyone.
It's huge.
And so we've got to kind of what do I want to say? Like, sort of weed out the negative stereotypes and so on, and start feeding ourselves more positive images. And that's why I think this book is a great start for that, because you start to see the mythological stories. Other, you know, mythological stories that, you know, that would fit this, obviously. I mean, we're looking at the Parsifal Grail legend, and you've got the Arthurian legends and so forth. You've got the mythology of Gilgamesh. You've got all of the hero's journey type. Joseph Campbell's work on the hero's journey is excellent. There's a book on the Holy Grail that Emma Jung and von Franz did, which has a lot of really great information in it.
Right.
So again, we discussed Robert Johnson, today, and we highly recommend that you purchase that. It's available out there on Amazon or anywhere you buy books. It's a bestseller, and it's very cheaply purchased and highly recommended by both of us.
And actually, if you look on YouTube, somebody has narrated the book on YouTube.
Oh,
so
fantastic. So if
it's another option.
If you want to listen to that for free, check it out on YouTube as well. So I think that's about all we can cover today, unfortunately.
Sure.
Thank you so much for discussing, Chris, with me today, this important book. And so they can find more about you at Chris Sheridan, ChrisSheridan.com, or they can look you up on Amazon and get your book, The Spirit in the Sky. And I think the website you've got, do you have contact information there, what have you?
I think so.
You're updating it or what have you. I think you're in the process.
I'm in the process. Yeah, it's not there yet.
All right. So I am updating all my stuff as well. So there's no crime in that.
All right.
And I have my book up as well. So check that out if you get a chance. There'll be a little plug for that at the end. Thank you for joining us on the Cosmic Eye Show. And again, thank you, Chris Sheridan, for co-hosting with me, speaking about Robert Johnson's He.
Well, thank you for
having
me.
Appreciate it. Thank you, brother. And we will be speaking again soon. All right.
Sounds terrific.
All right, everybody, have a great week. God bless.
Bless.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you for listening, and please join us next Sunday for a new episode of Cosmic Eye. You can purchase If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate at Amazon.com or through our website, cosmiceye.org.